This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Stillness is the Key. This is the author, Ryan Holiday. The struggle is great, the task divine, to gain mastery, freedom, happiness, and tranquility. Epictetus. Preface. It was the late 1st century AD, and Lucius Annaeus Seneca, Rome's most influential power broker, its greatest living playwright, and its wisest philosopher, was struggling to work. The problem was the ear-shattering, soul-rattling noise that poured in from the street below. Rome had always been a loud city. Think New York City construction loud. But the block where Seneca was staying was a deafening cacophony of disturbances. Athletes worked out in the gymnasium underneath his suite of rooms, dropping heavy weights. A masseuse pummeled the backs of old fat men. Swimmers splashed in the water. At the entrance of the building, a pickpocket was being arrested and making a scene. Passing carriages rumbled over the stone streets, while carpenters hammered away in their shops, and vendors shouted their wares. Children laughed and played. Dogs barked. And more than the noise outside his window, there was the simple fact that Seneca's life was falling apart. It was crisis upon crisis upon crisis. Overseas unrest threatened his finances. He was getting older and could feel it. He had been pushed out of politics by his enemies, and now on the outs with Nero, he could easily, at the emperor's whim, lose his head. It was not, we can imagine, from the perspective of our own busy lives, a great environment for a human to get anything done. Unconducive to thinking, creating, writing, or making good decisions. The noise and distractions of the empire were enough to make me hate my very powers of hearing, Seneca told a friend. Yet for good reason, this scene has tantalized admirers for centuries. How does a man, besieged by adversity and difficulty, not only not go out of his mind, but actually find the serenity to think clearly and to write incisive, perfectly crafted essays, some in that very room, which would reach millions upon millions and touch on truths that few have ever accessed? I have toughened my nerves against all that sort of thing, Seneca explained to that same friend about the noise. I force my mind to concentrate and keep it from straying to things outside itself. All outdoors may be bedlam, provided that there is no disturbance within. Ah, isn't that what we all crave? What discipline, what focus, to be able to tune out our surroundings, to access one's full capabilities at any time, in any place, despite every difficulty. How wonderful that would be. What we'd be able to accomplish, how much happier we would be. To Seneca and his fellow adherents of Stoic philosophy, if a person could develop peace within themselves, if they could achieve apatheia, as they called it, then the whole world could be at war, and they could still think well, work well, and be well. You may be sure that you are at peace with yourself, Seneca wrote, when no noise reaches you. When no word shakes you out of yourself, whether it be flattery or a threat, or merely an empty sound buzzing about you with unmeaning sin. In this state, nothing could touch them, not even a deranged emperor. No emotion could disturb them, no threat could interrupt them, and every beat of the present moment would be theirs for living. It's a powerful idea made all the more transcendent by the remarkable fact that nearly every other philosophy of the ancient world, no matter how different or distant, came to the exact same conclusion. It wouldn't have mattered whether you were a pupil at the feet of Confucius in 500 BC, a student of the early Greek philosopher Democritus 100 years later, or sitting in Epicurus's garden a generation after that. You would have heard equally emphatic calls for this imperturbability, unruffledness, and tranquility. The Buddhist word for it was upekkha, The Muslims spoke of Islama. The Hebrews, Hishtavut. The second book of the Bhagavad Gita, the epic poem of the warrior Arjuna, speaks of Samatvam, an evenness of mind, a peace that is ever the same. The Greeks, Euthymia and Hesychia. The Epicureans, Ataraxia. The Christians, Equanimitas. In English, stillness. To be steady while the world spins around you. To act without frenzy. To hear only what needs to be heard. To possess quietude, exterior and interior, on command. To tap into the Tao and the Logos, the Word, the Way. Buddhism, Stoicism, Epicureanism, Christianity, Hinduism. It's all but impossible to find a philosophical school or religion that does not venerate this inner peace, this stillness, as the highest good and as a key to elite performance and a happy life. And when basically all the wisdom of the ancient world agrees on something, only a fool would decline to listen. Introduction. The call to stillness comes quietly. The modern world does not. In addition to the clatter and chatter and intrigue and infighting that would be familiar to the citizens of Seneca's time, we have car horns, stereos, cell phone alarms, social media notifications, chainsaws, airplanes. Our personal and professional problems are equally overwhelming. Competitors muscle into our industry, our desks pile high with papers, and our inboxes overflow with messages. We are always reachable, which means that arguments and updates are never far away. The news bombards us with one crisis after another on every screen we own, of which there are many. The grind of work wears us down and seems to never stop. We are overfed and undernourished. Overstimulated, overscheduled, and lonely. Who has the power to stop? Who has time to think? Is there anyone not affected by the din and dysfunctions of our time? While the magnitude and urgency of our struggle is modern, it is rooted in a timeless problem. Indeed, history shows that the ability to cultivate quiet and quell the turmoil inside us, to slow the mind down, to understand our emotions, and to conquer our bodies has always been extremely difficult. All of humanity's problems, Blaise Pascal said in 1654, stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. In evolution, distinct species like birds and bats have often evolved similar adaptations in order to survive. The same goes for the philosophical schools separated by vast oceans and distances. They developed unique paths to the same critical destination, the stillness required to become master of one's own life, to survive and thrive in any and every environment, no matter how loud or busy. Which is why this idea of stillness is not some soft New Age nonsense or the domain of monks and sages, but in fact desperately necessary to all of us, whether we're running a hedge fund or playing in the Super Bowl, pioneering research in a new field, or raising a family. It is an attainable path to enlightenment and excellence, greatness and happiness, performance as well as presence for every kind of person. Stillness is what aims the archer's arrow. It inspires new ideas. It sharpens perspectives and illuminates connections. It slows the ball down so that we might hit it. It generates a vision, helps us resist the passions of the mob, makes space for gratitude and wonder. Stillness allows us to persevere, to succeed. It is the key that unlocks the insights of genius and allows us regular folks to understand them. The promise of this book is the location of that key, and a call not only for possessing stillness, but for radiating it outward like a star, like the sun, for a world that needs light more than ever. the key to everything. In the early days of the American Civil War, there were 100 competing plans for how to secure victory and whom to appoint to do it. From every general and for every battle, there was an endless supply of criticism and dangerous passions. There was paranoia and fear, ego and arrogance, and very little in the way of hope. There is a wonderful scene from those fraught first moments when Abraham Lincoln addressed a group of generals and politicians in his office at the White House. Most people at that time believed the war could only be won through enormous, decisively bloody battles in the country's biggest cities, like Richmond and New Orleans, and even potentially Washington, D.C. Lincoln, a man who taught himself military strategy by poring over books he checked out from the Library of Congress, laid out a map across a big table and pointed instead to Vicksburg, Mississippi, a little city deep in Southern Territory. It was a fortified town high on the bluffs of the Mississippi River, held by the toughest rebel troops. Not only did it control navigation of that important waterway, but it was the juncture for a number of important other tributaries, as well as rail lines that supplied Confederate armies and enormous slave plantations across the South. "Vicksburg is the key," he told the crowd with the certainty of a man who had studied a matter so intensely that he could express it in the simplest of terms. "The war can never be brought to a close until that key is in our pocket." As it happened, Lincoln turned out to be exactly right. It would take years. It would take incredible equanimity and patience, as well as ferocious commitment to his cause. But the strategy laid out in that room was what won the war and ended slavery in America forever. Every other important victory in the Civil War, from Gettysburg to Sherman's March to the Sea to Lee's surrender, was made possible because at Lincoln's instruction, Ulysses S. Grant laid siege to Vicksburg in 1863, and by taking the city, split the South in two and gained control of that important waterway. In his reflective, intuitive manner, without being rushed or distracted, Lincoln had seen and held fast to what his own advisors, even his enemy, had missed. Because he possessed the key that unlocked victory from the rancor and folly of all those early competing plans. In our own lives, we face a seemingly equal number of problems and are pulled in countless directions by competing priorities and beliefs. In the way of everything we hope to accomplish, personally and professionally, sit obstacles and enemies. Martin Luther King Jr. observed that there was a violent civil war raging within each and every person, between our good and bad impulses, between our ambitions and our principles, between what we can be and how hard it is to actually get there. In those battles, in that war, stillness is the river and the railroad junction through which so much depends. It is the key to thinking clearly, to seeing the whole chessboard, to making tough decisions, to managing our emotions, to identifying the right goals, to handling high-pressure situations, to maintaining relationships, to building good habits, to being productive, to physical excellence, to feeling fulfilled, to capturing moments of laughter and joy. Stillness is the key to, well, just about everything. To being a better parent, a better artist, a better investor, a better athlete, a better scientist, a better human being. To unlocking all that we are capable of in this life. This stillness can be yours. Anyone who has concentrated so deeply that a flash of insight or inspiration suddenly visited them knows stillness. Anyone who has given their best to something, felt pride of completion, of knowing they left absolutely nothing in reserve, that's stillness. Anyone who has stepped forward with the eyes of the crowd upon them and then poured all their training into a single moment of performance, that's stillness. Even if it involves active movement. Anyone who has spent time with that special wise person and witnessed them solve in 2 seconds the problem that had vexed us for months, stillness. Anyone who has walked out alone on a quiet street at night as the snow fell and watched as the light fell softly on that snow and is warmed by the contentment of being alive, that too, stillness. Staring at the blank page in front of us and watching as the words pour out in perfect prose, at a loss for where they came from, standing on fine white sand, looking out at the ocean, or really any part of nature, and feeling like a part of something bigger than oneself, a quiet evening with a loved one, the satisfaction of having done a good turn for another person, sitting alone with our thoughts, and seizing for the first time the ability to think about them as we are thinking them. Stillness. Sure, there is a certain ineffableness to what we're talking about, to articulating the stillness that the poet Rainer Maria Rilke described as full, complete, where all the random and approximate were muted. Although we speak of attaining the Tao, Lao Tzu once said, there is really nothing to obtain. Or to borrow a master's reply to a student who asked where he might find Zen, you are seeking for an ox while you yourself are on it. You have tasted stillness before. You have felt it in your soul, and you want more of it. You need more of it. Which is why the aim of this book is simply to show how to uncover and draw upon the stillness we already possess. It's about the cultivation of and the connection to that powerful force given to us at birth, the one that has atrophied in our modern busy lives. This book is an attempt to answer the pressing question of our time. If the quiet moments are the best moments, and if so many wise, virtuous people have sung their praises, why are they so rare? Well, the answer is that while we may naturally possess stillness, accessing it is not easy. One must really listen to hear it speaking to us, and answering the call requires stamina and mastery. To hold the mind still is an enormous discipline, the late comedian Gary Shandling reminded himself in his journals as he struggled to manage fame and fortune and health problems, one which must be faced with the greatest commitment of your life. The pages that follow tell the stories and strategies of men and women who were just like you, who struggled as you struggle amid the noise and responsibilities of life, but managed to succeed in finding and harnessing stillness. You will hear stories of the triumphs and trials of John F. Kennedy and Fred Rogers, Anne Frank and Queen Victoria. There will be stories about Jesus and Tiger Woods, Socrates, Napoleon, the composer John Cage, Sadaharu Oh, Roseanne Cash, Dorothy Day, Buddha, Leonardo da Vinci, and Marcus Aurelius. We will also draw on poetry and novels, philosophical texts, and scientific research. We will raid every school in every era we can to find strategies to help us direct our thoughts, process our emotions, and master our bodies. So we can do less and do more, accomplish more, but need it less, feel better, and be better at the same time. To achieve stillness, we'll need to focus on three domains, the timeless trinity of mind, body, soul, the head, the heart, and the flesh. In each domain, we will seek to reduce the disturbances and perturbations that make stillness impossible, to cease to be at war with the world and within ourselves, and to establish a lasting inner and outer peace instead. You know that is what you want and what you deserve. That's why you picked up this book. So let us answer the call together. Let us find, let us lock into the stillness that we seek. Part 1. Mind. The mind is restless, Krishna, impetuous, self-willed, hard to train. To master the mind seems as difficult as to master the mighty winds. The Bhagavad Gita. The domain of the mind. The entire world changed in the few short hours between when John F. Kennedy went to bed on October 15, 1962, and when he woke up the following morning. Because while the president slept, the CIA identified the ongoing construction of medium and long-range Soviet ballistic nuclear missiles on the island of Cuba, just 90 miles from American shores. As Kennedy would tell a stunned American public days later, each of these missiles is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States, in Central America, or in the Caribbean. As Kennedy received his first briefing on what we now know as the Cuban Missile Crisis, or simply the 13 days, the president could consider only the appalling stakes. As many as 70 million people were expected to die in the first strikes between the United States and Russia. But that was just a guess. No one actually knew how terrible nuclear war would be. What Kennedy knew for certain was that he faced an unprecedented escalation of the long brewing Cold War between the United States and the USSR. And whatever factors had contributed to its creation, no matter how inevitable war must have appeared, it fell on him, at the very least, to just not make things worse, because it might mean the end of life on planet Earth. Kennedy was a young president born into immense privilege, raised by an aggressive father who hated to lose, and a family whose motto, they joked, was "Don't get mad, get even." With almost no executive leadership experience under his belt, it's not a surprise then that the first year and a half of Kennedy's administration had not gone well. In April 1961, Kennedy had tried and failed, embarrassingly so, to invade Cuba and overthrow Fidel Castro at the Bay of Pigs. Just a few months later, he was diplomatically dominated by Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev in a series of meetings in Vienna. Kennedy would call it the roughest thing in my life. Sensing his adversary's political weakness and likely aware of the chronic physical frailty he endured from Addison's disease and back injuries suffered during World War II, Khrushchev repeatedly lied to Kennedy about any weapons being placed in Cuba, insisting that they would be for defensive purposes only. Which is to say that during the missile crisis, Kennedy faced, as every leader will at some point in their tenure, a difficult test amid complicating personal and political circumstances. There were so many questions. Why would Khrushchev do this? What was his end game? What was the man possibly trying to accomplish? Was there a way to solve it? What did Kennedy's advisors think? What were Kennedy's options? Was he up to this task? Did he have what it took? The fate of millions depended on his answers. The advice from Kennedy's advisors was immediate and emphatic. The missile sites must be destroyed with the full might of the country's military arsenal. Every second wasted risked the safety and the reputation of the United States. After the surprise attack on the missiles, a full-scale invasion of Cuba by American troops would need to follow. This, they said, was not only more than justified by the actions of the USSR in Cuba, but it was Kennedy's only option. Their logic was both primal and satisfying. Aggression must be met with aggression, tit replied to with tat. The only problem was that if their logic turned out to be wrong, no one would be around to account for their mistake, because everyone would be dead. Unlike in the early days of his presidency, when Kennedy allowed the CIA to pressure him into supporting the Bay of Pigs fiasco, this time he surprised everyone by pushing back. He had recently read Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August, a book about the beginning of World War I, which imprinted on his mind the image of overconfident world leaders rushing their way into a conflict that, once started, they couldn't stop. Kennedy wanted everyone to slow down so that they could really think about the problem in front of them. This is, in fact, the first obligation of a leader and a decision maker. Our job is not to go with our gut or fixate on the first impression we form about an issue. No, we need to be strong enough to resist thinking that is too neat, too plausible, and therefore almost always wrong. Because if the leader can't take the time to develop a clear sense of the bigger picture, who will? If the leader isn't thinking all the way through to the end, who is? We can see in Kennedy's handwritten notes taken during the crisis a sort of meditative process by which he tried to do precisely this. On numerous pages, he writes missile, 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 or veto, 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 or leaders, leaders, leaders. On one page, showing his desire not to act alone or selfishly, consensus, 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 consensus. On a yellow legal pad during one meeting, Kennedy drew two sailboats, calming himself with thoughts of the ocean he loved so much. Finally, on White House stationery, as if to clarify to himself the only thing that mattered, he wrote one short sentence. We are demanding withdrawal of the missiles. Perhaps it was there, as Kennedy sat with his advisors and doodled, that he remembered a passage from another book he'd read by the strategist B.H. Liddell Hart on nuclear strategy. In Kennedy's review of Hart's book for the Saturday Review of Literature a few years before, he quoted this passage. Keep strong if possible. In any case, keep cool. Have unlimited patience. Never corner an opponent and always assist him to save face. Put yourself in his shoes so as to see things through his eyes. Avoid self-righteousness like the devil. Nothing is so self-blinding. It became Kennedy's motto during the missile crisis. I think we ought to think of why the Russians did this, he told his advisors. What is the advantage they are trying to get, he asked with real interest. Must be some major reason for the Soviets to set this up. As Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Kennedy's advisor and biographer, wrote, with his capacity to understand the problems of others, the president could see how threatening the world might have looked to the Kremlin. This understanding would help him respond properly to this unexpected and dangerous provocation and give him insight into how the Soviets would react to that response. It became clear to Kennedy that Khrushchev put the missiles in Cuba because he believed Kennedy was weak. But that didn't mean the Russians believed their own position was particularly strong. Only a desperate nation would take such a risk, Kennedy realized. Armed with this insight, which came through long discussions with his team, designated as XCOM, he began to formulate an action plan. Clearly, a military strike was the most irrevocable of all the options. Nor, according to his advisors, was it likely to be 100% effective. What would happen after that, Kennedy wondered. How many soldiers would die in an invasion? How would the world respond to a larger country invading a smaller one, even if it was to deter a nuclear threat? What would the Russians do to save face or protect their soldiers on the island? These questions pointed Kennedy toward a blockade of Cuba. Nearly half of his advisors opposed this less aggressive move, but he favored it precisely because it preserved his options. The blockade also embodied the wisdom of one of Kennedy's favorite expressions. It used time as a tool. It gave both sides a chance to examine the stakes of the crisis and offered Khrushchev the opportunity to reevaluate his impression of Kennedy's supposed weakness. Some would later attack Kennedy for this choice too. Why challenge Russia at all? Why were the missiles such a big deal? Didn't the United States have plenty of their own pointed at the Soviets? Kennedy was not unsympathetic to this argument, but as he explained to the American public in an address on October 22nd, it wasn't possible to simply back down. The 1930s taught us a clear lesson. Aggressive conduct, if allowed to go unchecked and unchallenged, ultimately leads to war. This nation is opposed to war. We are also true to our word. Our unswerving objective, therefore, must be to prevent the use of these missiles against this or any other country, and to secure their withdrawal or elimination from the Western Hemisphere. We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the cost of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. What's most remarkable about this conclusion is how calmly Kennedy came to it. Despite the enormous stress of the situation, we can hear in tapes and see in transcripts and photos taken at the time just how collaborative and open everyone was. No fighting, no raised voices, no finger pointing, and when things did get tense, Kennedy laughed it off. Kennedy didn't let his own ego dominate the discussions, nor did he allow anyone else's to. When he sensed that his presence was stifling his advisors' ability to speak honestly, he left the room so they could debate and brainstorm freely. Reaching across party lines and past rivalries, he consulted openly with the three still-living ex-presidents and invited the previous Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, into the top-secret meetings as an equal. In the tensest moments, Kennedy sought solitude in the White House Rose Garden. Afterward, he would thank the gardener for her important contributions during the crisis. He would go for long swims, both to clear his mind and to think. He sat in his specially made rocking chair in the Oval Office, bathed in the light of those enormous windows, easing the pain in his back so that it might not add to the fog of Cold War that had descended so thickly over Washington and Moscow. There is a picture of Kennedy with his back to the room, hunched over, leaning both fists on the big desk he had been chosen by millions of voters to occupy. This is a man with the fate of the world on his shoulders. He has been provoked by a nuclear superpower in a surprise act of bad faith. Critics are questioning his courage. There are political considerations, personal considerations. There are more factors than any one person should be able to weigh at one time. Yet he lets none of this rush him. None of it will cloud his judgment or deter him from doing the right thing. He is the stillest guy in the room. Kennedy would need to stay that way, because simply deciding on the blockade was only the first step. Next came announcing and enforcing this 500-mile no-go zone around Cuba, which he brilliantly called a quarantine to underplay the more aggressive implications of a blockade. There would be more belligerent accusations from the Russians and confrontations at the UN. Congressional leaders voiced their doubts. 100,000 troops still had to be readied in Florida as a contingency. Then there would be actual provocations. A Russian tanker ship approached the quarantine line. Russian submarines surfaced. An American U-2 spy plane was shot down over Cuba and the pilot killed. The two biggest and most powerful countries in the world were eyeball to eyeball. It was actually scarier and more dire than anyone knew. Some of the Soviet missiles, which had been previously thought to be only partly assembled, were armed and ready. Even if this wasn't known, the awful danger could be felt. Would Kennedy's emotions get the best of him? Would he blink? Would he break? No, he wouldn't. "It isn't the first step that concerns me," he said to his advisors as much as to himself. "But both sides escalating to the fourth and fifth step, and we don't go to the sixth because there is no one around to do so. We must remind ourselves we are embarking on a very hazardous course." The space Kennedy gave Khrushchev to breathe and think paid off just in time. On October 26th, 11 days into the crisis, the Soviet premier wrote Kennedy a letter saying that he now saw that the two of them were pulling on a rope with a knot in the middle, a knot of war. The harder each pulled, the less likely it would be that they could ever untie it, and eventually there would be no choice but to cut the rope with a sword. And then Khrushchev provided an even more vivid analogy, one as true in geopolitics as it is in everyday life. If people do not display statesman-like wisdom, he said, they will eventually reach the point where they will clash like blind moles, and then mutual annihilation will commence. Suddenly, the crisis was over as quickly as it began. The Russians, realizing that their position was untenable and that their test of U.S. resolve had failed, made signs that they would negotiate, that they would remove the missiles. The ships stopped dead in the water. Kennedy was ready, too. He pledged that the U.S. would not invade Cuba, giving the Russians and their allies a win. In secret, he also let the Russians know that he was willing to remove American missiles in Turkey, but would do so in several months' time so as not to give the impression that he could be pressured into abandoning an ally. With clear thinking, wisdom, patience, and a keen eye for the root of a complex, provocative conflict, Kennedy had saved the world from a nuclear holocaust. We might say that Kennedy, if only for this brief period of a little less than 2 weeks, managed to achieve that state of clarity spoken about in the ancient Chinese text, the Tao Te Ching. As he stared down nuclear annihilation, he was careful as someone crossing over an iced over stream, alert as a warrior in enemy territory, courteous as a guest, fluid as melting ice, shapeable as a block of wood, receptive as a valley, clear as a glass of water. The Taoists would say that he had stilled the muddy water in his mind until he could see through it. Or to borrow the image from the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic philosopher who himself had stared down countless crises and challenges. Kennedy had been like the rock that the waves keep crashing over. It stands unmoved, and the raging of the sea falls still around it. Each of us will, in our own lives, face crisis. The stakes may be lower, but to us, they will matter. A business on the brink of collapse, an acrimonious divorce, a decision about the future of our career, a moment where the whole game depends on us. These situations will call upon all our mental resources, an emotional reactive response, an unthinking half-baked response will not cut it. Not if we want to get it right. Not if we want to perform at our best. What we will need then is that same stillness that Kennedy drew upon, his calmness, his open-mindedness, his empathy, his clarity about what really mattered. In these situations, we must be fully present, empty our mind of preconceptions, take our time, sit quietly and reflect, reject distraction, weigh advice against the counsel of our convictions, deliberate without being paralyzed. We must cultivate mental stillness to succeed in life and to successfully navigate the many crises it throws our way. It will not be easy, but it is essential. For the rest of his short life, Kennedy worried that people would learn the wrong lessons from his actions during the missile crisis. It wasn't that he'd stood up to the Soviets and threatened them with superior weapons until they backed down. Instead, calm and rational leadership had prevailed over rasher, reckless voices. The crisis was resolved thanks to a mastery of his own thinking and the thinking of those underneath him. And it was these traits that America would need to call on repeatedly in the years to come. The lesson was not one of force, but of the power of patience, alternating confidence and humility, foresight and presence, empathy and unbending conviction, restraint and toughness, quiet solitude combined with wise counsel. How much better would the world be with more of this behavior? How much better would your own life be? Kennedy, like Lincoln, was not born with this stillness. He was a defiant troublemaker in high school, a dilettante for most of college, and even as a senator. He had his demons, and he made plenty of mistakes. But with hard work, work you are capable of doing too, he overcame these shortcomings and developed the equanimity that served him so well over those terrifying 13 days. It was work in just a few categories that nearly everyone else neglects, which is where we will now turn our focus, toward mastering what we will call in this section the domain of the mind, because everything we do depends on getting that right. Become present. Trust no future, howe'er pleasant. Let the past bury its dead. Act, act in the living present, heart within, and God o'erhead. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The decision in 2010 to title Marina Abramović's four-decade retrospective at MoMA in New York City, The Artist is Present, all but preordained the monumental performance that would come out of it. Naturally, Marina would have to be present in one way or another. But no one would have dared think that she would literally be there for all of it. Who could conceive that a human being could sit silently in a chair, completely still, for a total of 750 hours over 79 days, directly across from 1,545 strangers, without aid, without distraction, without so much as a way to go to the bathroom? That she would want to do this? That she would pull it off? As her former lover and collaborator Ule said when he was asked what he thought of the possibility, "I have no thoughts, only respect." The performance was as simple as it was straightforward. Marina, age 63, her long hair braided and over her shoulder, walked in to the cavernous room, sat down in a hard wooden chair, and simply stared at the person across from her. One after another they came, hour after hour, day in and day out, for nearly 3 months. Each time she looked down, gathered herself, and then looked up afresh at the new face. As Marina would say of her art, the proposition here is just to empty the self, to be able to be present. Is it really that hard to be present? What's so special about that? No one who was in the audience who sat across from her would ask such questions. For those lucky enough to see the performance in person, it was a near religious experience. To experience another person fully in the moment is a rare thing. To feel them engage with you, to be giving all their energy to you, as though there is nothing else that matters in the world, is rarer still. To see them do it for so long, so intensely. Many viewers cried. Each one said the hours in line were worth it. It was like looking in a kind of mirror where they could feel their own life for the first time. Imagine if Marina's mind drifted, if she daydreamed, the person across from her could immediately sense that she was somewhere else. If she slowed her mind and body down too much, she might have fallen asleep. If she allowed for normal bodily sensations, hunger, discomfort, pain, the urge to go to the bathroom, it would have been impossible not to move or get up. If she began to think of how much time was left in the day's performance, time would slow to an intolerable crawl. So with monk-like discipline and warrior-like strength, she ignored these distractions to exist exclusively in the present moment. She had to be where her feet were. She had to care about the person across from her and the experience they were sharing more than anything else in the world. People don't understand that the hardest thing is actually doing something that is close to nothing, Abramović said. about the performance. It demands all of you. There is no object to hide behind. It's just you. Being present demands all of us. It's not nothing. It may be the hardest thing in the world. As we stand on the podium about to give a speech, our mind is focused not on our task, but on what everyone will think of us. How does that not affect our performance? As we struggle with a crisis, our mind repeats on loop just how unfair this is, how insane it is that it keeps happening to us, and how it can't go on. Why are we draining ourselves of essential emotional and mental energies right when we need them most? Even during a quiet evening at home, all we're thinking about is the list of improvements that need to be made. There may be a beautiful sunset, but instead of taking it in, we're taking a picture of it. We are not present, and so we miss out on life, on being our best, on seeing what's there. Many of the people in line to see Marina Abramović's performance accidentally illustrate this phenomena. Rushing in as the doors opened, they zoomed past equally impressive pieces from her career so that they could be first in line for the special one. In line, they fidgeted endlessly and chatted with each other, trying to kill time as the hours ticked by. They napped, leaning up against one another. They checked their phones and then checked them again. They planned what they would do when it was their turn and speculated about what it would be like. Some of them worked in secret on little stunts they hoped would bring them 15 seconds of fame. How much ordinary wonderfulness they closed their minds to. It makes you wonder, after they had their transcendent experience with Marina, coming face to face with real presence, when they left the museum and walked out into the busy New York City street, did they breathe in anew the vibrant rhythm of the urban jungle? Or more likely, did they immediately resume their busy lives, full of distractions, anxiety, dreams, insecurities, and ego? In short, did they do exactly what all of us do most of every single day? We do not live in this moment. In fact, we try desperately to get out of it by thinking, doing, talking, worrying, remembering, hoping, whatever. We pay thousands of dollars to have a device in our pocket to ensure that we are never bored. We sign up for endless activities and obligations, chase money and accomplishments, all with the naive belief that at the end of it will be happiness. Tolstoy observed that love can't exist off in the future. Love is only real if it's happening right now. If you think about it, that's true for basically everything we think, feel, or do. The best athletes in the biggest games are completely there. They are within themselves, within the now. Remember, there's no greatness in the future, or clarity, or insight, or happiness, or peace. There is only this moment. Not that we mean literally 60 seconds. The real present moment is what we choose to exist in, instead of lingering on the past or fretting about the future. It's however long we can push away the impressions of what's happened before and what we worry or hope might occur at some other time. Right now can be a few minutes or a morning or a year if you can stay in it that long. As Laura Ingalls Wilder said, now is now. It can never be anything else. Seize it. Who is so talented that they can afford to bring only part of themselves to bear on a problem or opportunity? Whose relationships are so strong that they can get away with not showing up? Who is so certain that they'll get another moment that they can confidently skip over this one? The less energy we waste regretting the past or worrying about the future, the more energy we will have for what's in front of us. We want to learn to see the world like an artist. While other people are oblivious to what surrounds them, the artist really sees. Their mind, fully engaged, notices the way a bird flies, or the way a stranger holds their fork, or the way a mother looks at her child. They have no thoughts of the morrow. All they are thinking about is how to capture and communicate this experience. An artist is present. And from this stillness comes brilliance. This moment we are experiencing right now is a gift. That's why we call it the present. Even if it is a stressful, trying experience, it could be our last. So let's develop the ability to be in it, to put everything we have into appreciating the plentitude of the now. Don't reject a difficult or boring moment because it is not exactly what you want. Don't waste a beautiful moment because you are insecure or shy. Make what you can of what you have been given. Live what can be lived. That's what excellence is. That's what presence makes possible. In meditation, teachers instruct students to focus on their breath, in and out, in and out. In sports, coaches speak of the process, this play, this drill, this rep, not just because this moment is special, but because you can't do your best if your mind is elsewhere. We would do well to follow this in our own lives. Jesus told his disciples not to worry about tomorrow because tomorrow will take care of itself. Another way of saying that is you have plenty on your plate right now. Focus on that, no matter how small or insignificant it is. Do the very best you can right now. Don't think about what detractors may say. Don't dwell or needlessly complicate. Be here. Be all of you. Be present. And if you've had trouble with this in the past, that's okay. That's the nice thing about the present. It keeps showing up to give you a second chance. Limit your inputs. A wealth of information creates a poverty of attention. Herbert Simon.